The Be Rad podcast is brought to you by MOFO, male optimization formula with organs to boost testosterone. Brad's macadamia masterpiece, mind-blowing nut butter blend now available on Amazon. Bala enzyme, electrolyte and triple enzyme recovery drink mix. Paleo Valley, nutrient-rich, ancestral-inspired health products. By Optimizers, performance supplements like magnesium, probiotics, and more. And B-Rad Whey Protein Superfuel, coming soon. Stay tuned for details. And please visit bradkearns.com to check out my personal selection of favorite products for health, fitness, and peak performance with great discounts for listeners. And here we go with the show.
The whole struggle, particularly as master, you work your way up the master's ranks, is just getting to the starting line. You know, in general, even though I would like to draw on the more scientific things, I prefer to be much more like him. Like, can I create stuff that's applicable and meaningful and still evidence-based for the average person? Yes, you may then adapt and perform better later, but don't tell yourself that this is going to make you live longer.
I want to talk about the best magnesium supplement from Bioptimizers. Did you know that magnesium is believed to be one of the most widely deficient micronutrients, that it's involved in 600 different enzyme reactions in the body, and that 75% of modern citizens fail to get enough from their diets? This is due to depleted soil, missing the truly magnesium-rich foods, and stressful lifestyle patterns depleting magnesium levels. It's definitely one of the most important supplements, and Bioptimizers has a sensational product called Magnesium Breakthrough, the only organic full-spectrum magnesium supplement that includes 7 unique forms of magnesium for stress relief and better sleep. Visit magbreakthrough.com/Brad, and you get an incredibly informative page on how the product will benefit you and the best ways to use it. You'll also save 10% on that page or by using the code BRAD10 at checkout. Try the product with a full money-back guarantee from Bioptimizers. Visit magbreakthrough, magbreakthrough.com/Brad, or use the code BRAD10 at checkout. Hey, listeners, what an incredible treat to welcome back to the show. I believe this is the 4th official show with Dr. Tommy Wood, counting my recap show. And we cover an incredible variety of topics on this fast-moving, ever-interesting show about all matters of healthy living, longevity, but starting out with this idea that Tommy's conveyed recently about the second guessing of this constant quest for optimization in the area of health and fitness. And what he calls it is the pathologizing of health practices, the over obsession with eating perfectly or getting your exact optimal sleep environment, especially relevant to me because I'm such a baby when it comes to getting my perfect amount of sleep. He cites a lot of research. He's deep into the academic field, working in the area of brain research and brain injuries at the University of Washington in Seattle and on his professor track, but he still keeps his toe into the health scene very nicely. He's got a great Instagram site, and please follow him for all kinds of helpful, practical, and commonsensical tips and insights. Here's a recent quote that I love that he shared on another show, the Finding Mastery podcast, and this kind of teed up the beginning of our conversation. Then I'll tell you really quickly some of the other interesting topics that we cover. But Tommy said, one thing I'm really concerned about is in the biohacking community is the pathologization and objectification of many things that should bring us joy, mainly food and sleep. As soon as you start to quantify something, you can lose the joy in it. You start to objectify it, and it's no longer a thing that can bring you joy in the same way. So have the necessary knowledge, but then don't overcomplicate or overfocus on it. That tees up some follow-up questions about if towing that fine line between saying, hey, life is short, might as well enjoy it, and then drifting down the path the destructive path that we follow in modern life toward disease and demise because we aren't keeping our game straight. So I hit him with that question in the show. You're going to learn about the pros and cons, and particularly the cons of the continuous glucose monitor and over-obsessing about how meals are affecting your glucose. We're going to talk about sleep, as I mentioned before, and we get deep into the fitness concepts because he's an extreme fitness enthusiast himself. And he's pretty modest on the show, but this is a highly fit, highly muscled individual that works very hard in the gym and is cutting edge and works with a lot of top athletes there. So you're going to love the fitness insights as well as the diet, things about how the placebo effect is real and extremely powerful, even if you know it's placebo. So, boy, I loved it. I hope you love it as much as I do. We'll get him back on the show on a regular basis. There's nobody like him. And I urge you to go back and listen to the other shows, because if you're looking for basic common sense, overall big picture health and longevity advice, Dr. Tommy Wood, there are a few better to listen to. So here we go. Dr. Tommy Wood, I don't say this too often, but you're absolutely one of my favorite guests ever. Same with a lot of listeners. I think this is like maybe the fourth official podcast, counting my Dr. Tommy Wood summary shows where I compile all the great stuff we talked about. But it's been a while, so thanks a lot for reconnecting. We got tons to talk about.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. Really happy to chat with you again. You're right. It's been a couple of years and even longer since you were sat at my kitchen table, like surrounded by
white boxers, other colors,
nonstop
entertainment.
I'm really happy to be back and always enjoy chatting with you. So this is, I'm really looking forward to it.
So just before we hit record, we were talking about checking in on each other, and I'm reporting my athletic goals continue to compel me at age 57 to try to do my best. But I was saying, wow, you know, it's kind of a challenge because there's always something to complain about, aches, pains, niggles, delayed recovery and things like that. And you put up a really interesting goal, and that is forget about the finish line. Let's just have a goal of getting to the starting line. I'm like, dang, that's a revelation right there.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously you are an athlete and you embody many parts of what it is to be an athlete. And you know, being an athlete is part of your identity, which is, you know, you know, you want to continue to have that, so that there's a coherence between, you know, who you believe yourself to be and your actions, right? That's an important part of creating, you know, a long-term environment for ourselves that supports us. So I mean, that's great, but it's, you know, as we age, you know, as we all will, and you're doing pretty much everything we might say you should be doing in order to, you know, have that process take as long as possible. But it does happen, and it will happen. And particularly if you continue to be an athlete, the whole struggle, particularly as master, you know, you work your way up the master's ranks, is just getting to the starting line, right? You know, being in good shape, having the body, be physically fit and functioning. Everybody else is falling apart, or they give up on training and, you know, give up on competing. I think that's, you should celebrate that, you know, 57 in great shape, still doing great things. I see you on Instagram, you know, still looking pretty good. So I think that's all stuff to be celebrated.
Yeah. The identity of, getting old is not as empowering as keeping that identity of an athlete, but it is a tricky, situation. Mark Manson, you know, Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. Uh-huh. He has an interesting line where he says, try to have as little of a self identity as possible. That self-esteem and self-concept is a myth. It's a form of persistent low-level narcissism to try to cultivate self-esteem and instead see your life as a series of decisions and actions. And that quote echoes on me, because I know from back when I was a younger athlete and having my identity strongly attached to my athletic performance, it's a source of a potential continued pain and suffering when you're always, you know, nothing's ever good enough. And we can see that with the great champions of the world too, where they have a difficult adjusting to everyday life.
Yeah. I mean, I adore Mark Manson's work. He's my, you know, he's not a psychologist, but he's my favorite psychologist, because he can turn, you know, he turns evidence-based stuff into things that are applicable and there's an appropriate amount of swearing that always makes it more enjoyable to read. So one thing that I have found useful, so a friend of mine, Simon Marshall, Dr. Simon Marshall, is a psychologist. And when we've talked about this previously, you know, people get these things that sort of become part of who they are. So in the context we were talking about was people who have had a chronic disease for a long period of time, and it becomes part of their identity such that it's then hard, you know, even if they want to improve their health, it's hard to make those changes because, you know, maybe they're part of online support groups that are around their disease. Oof. Or, you know, they get a connection with other people, healthcare providers through their disease, and then it becomes part of like their beneficial support network. So then it's hard to divest from that as, you know, things change and maybe their health improves. And so his recommendation is, you maybe we don't think about not having an identity, but about diversifying our identity. So just like you would diversify your stock portfolio so that like if one thing crashes, you don't lose all your money, you would diversify your identities so that you have lots of identities to draw upon such that if one then is no longer accessible to you, so say being a professional athlete, you have lots of other things that form part of your identity. So, you know, like my identities, I still identify as an athlete. I'm a professor, a scientist, a dog lover, right? All of these things can then provide a buffer if I lose one of those. That would at least be the idea.
Yeah, I suppose that includes being open to wherever you're headed in the future and perhaps a new identity and a whole new, you know, set of beliefs around that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Wow. I didn't know you're a Mark Manson fan. That's kind of cool because, you know, the academic side and your traditional training and especially with brain research and all that, you know, it might be a somewhat of a difficult fit, but that's nice to know.
Yeah, I actually spent a lot more time telling my scientific colleagues how they're wrong in their application than I do otherwise. And mainly because, you know, as you get too deep into neuroscience, say, and people become really highly focused on specific small areas of the brain and specific signaling molecules and all that kind of stuff. And like, it's interesting, but like most of it isn't that useful. Whereas, you know, Mark Manson, maybe he sort of takes off some of the scientific edge of stuff, but like his stuff is useful. It's applicable. You identify with it. And so I, you know, in general, even though I would like to draw on the more scientific things, I would, you know, prefer to be much more like him. Like, can I create stuff that's applicable and meaningful and still evidence-based for the average person?
I guess that's kind of like Malcolm Gladwell being number one on the bestseller list with this string of books where he's accused and criticized of taking liberties with the science and bringing out an argument and then, you know, finding a way to support it to where he's convinced all the readers that if your child is born early in the year, they will play better in the hockey leagues and have an advantage the rest of their lifetime. Oh, wow, I guess I better hold my kid back from school. And then, you know, it can get refuted, but just having fun with it and making a case and bringing it out to the public is a different track that, you know, has a big impact, right?
Yeah, I think the stuff that I really like where this, it, you know, where that sort of the rubber meets the road on that for me is that are the things that you're sort of putting out there, do they have a large like positive asymmetry? Being that, you know, even if I don't have all the evidence in and randomized clinical trials, like, if I recommend something to you, is the risk so small that the potential benefit, you know, and is really great that it is worth trying anyway? Like, that's the stuff that I think people should focus on more rather than trying to like get into the nitty gritty details where we don't really know whether it's worth it or not.
Well, that kind of leads us to one of the topics I wanted to talk about, which you called the pathologizing of the extreme health pursuits, the biohacking, and how this can potentially be a net negative or you know, bring some negative energy into your life because you're so highly, tightly wound about doing everything correctly and optimally and being on the cutting edge at all times in every direction.
Yeah. Do you know what? I used to be all about optimizing. I use the word optimal all the time. right? And then you sort of realize that maybe that's not the best approach. Like, one, because half the time I don't even, like, I have a good idea what optimal might be, but that's at like an average level. Whereas, you know, it's very difficult to know exactly what's going to be optimal for you. And it could be your blood work or your sleep or a whole raft of other things. And I think the pursuit of optimal can become self-defeating. And I have two examples that I think are very relevant to the audience and to that kind of like biohacking group. The first one is sleep. And, you know, sleep trackers are all the rage nowadays in, you know, the kind of, with the kind of people that you and I hang out with, maybe not with the sort of the more general population.
sleep what? What's a sleep tracker? You yeah. like you put your bed on the rails and it goes up and down? No.
And you know, so I'm really glad that people are focusing on sleep and trying to sleep better. I think that's important, and that message is even like permeating into the general public now. Like it used to be, sleep when you're dead. All that kind of stuff. And now we know that, well, if you don't sleep, then you will be dead.
Sooner.
That will happen sooner. And although actually, I was giving a presentation to some health coaches this morning, like looking at sleep and risk of death. And it seems like you don't really start to see an increased risk of death unless your sleep regularly goes below 6 hours, which is actually less than I thought.
Wow.
You know, so that's a meaningful thing. I think if we're telling people you have to sleep at least 7 hours or else all this bad stuff's going to happen, not necessarily supported by the evidence. But with sleep tracking, what happens is that the goal becomes optimizing the numbers on the tracker. Whereas what the goal should be is getting restorative sleep that allows you to recover from your activities and be a more helpful, happy, healthful, cognitively performing person. And there's some issues with this. One is the quality of the data. So most sleep trackers, the data aren't great. They're fine for like tracking maybe trends over time, particularly if you're looking at sleep stages and stuff. But like if your sleep tracker tells you have X amount of deep sleep, you don't really know if that's true or not. And you also don't really know if that matters or not. But if we become hyper-focused on that number, right, then we start to lose the joy of sleep, right? It's this amazing thing which feels great and we get, you know, we should enjoy it, but there's actually a negative cognitive effect of becoming like hyper focused on these numbers. So that's like one part that and again you're pathologizing this process that is supposed to be joyful and restorative. And there is some evidence, and actually I'm stealing this right from Mark Manson because he wrote about this, where if you start to quantify and objectify a process or something in your life, you start to lose the joy in it. And so I actually, there were some papers on that I actually got from something that he wrote. So that concerns me. And then equally, we see something similar with continuous glucose monitoring. I want to continue on sleep. So there's a nice study done on sleep where they took individuals and they put them in, you know, like they had them in the lab, and then they had them sleep a certain amount of time, but they manipulated the clock time.
Brutal. Yeah. They signed off their rights before they started the study to get hosed.
Yeah.
I love it.
You slept either 8 hours or 5 hours. And then you were told you slept 8 hours or 5 hours, but they crossed them over. So you had people who slept 8 hours and were told they slept 5 hours and vice versa. And what they found was that if you slept for 5 hours, but you were told that you slept for 8 hours, you didn't feel more sleepy. Like you didn't feel more sleepy the next day because you thought you'd slept 8 hours. And if you slept 8 hours and were told that you slept for 5 hours, you had worse cognitive performance, which they measured with reaction time. So the reason why I'm worried about some sleep trackers or getting so worked up about this is because your sleep tracker says, hey, you had a bad night of sleep, and then you internalize that, and that will affect your cognitive performance regardless of whether that night of sleep would have affected it because of the cognitive effect of being told that you slept badly. So that's why I think like focusing on these numbers rather than the process is really an issue.
Oh, mercy. That is just brutal. And I have to think that
I could tell, right? I don't want to sign up and think that I'd be manipulated in such a way that I'd certainly know. It's kind of like, am I influenced by advertising? No, of course not. I pick whatever shoe is most comfortable and most functional. I don't mind the billboards or the magazine ads, but of course I'm lying to myself. But yeah, that's pretty heavy, because and especially relevant to me, because I've been such a little pretty boy about getting my correct sleep, dating back to my days as an athlete where, mm-hmm. you know, we're pretty much obsessed with getting maximum amount of sleep and recovering as quickly as possible. And I'm kind of fragile, I would say, in the mind and also the body, but maybe we could talk about that part where, because I'm so worked up about getting perfect sleep, maybe I'm becoming my own worst enemy. And not that I track anything, because I do feel like the mere act of tracking could bring some anxiety or some, you know, negative energy into the situation. So I definitely don't want to look at anything, but I know that I'm always trying to, you know, squeeze every last hour, minute, because I think it's so important. And if I don't get it, I'll have a less productive day.
Yeah, and I've noticed the same thing in myself, and then like people, clients, athletes that I've worked with. So which is why I think it's important to talk about it. Like, there are some people who, with enough exposure to the data or with the right kind of personality, can just like at a distance see the data, acknowledge it, you know, change something or appreciate that one night doesn't make a big difference, and then they can sort of, you know, keep moving forwards. But the majority being more than 50% of people can't do that. That, you know, tracking this stuff can have a negative impact. And I have also, you know, I've sort of worked with myself and others to acknowledge that, you know, one night, a couple of nights of bad sleep, in reality, if we look at sort of prolonged, lower amounts of sleep and health outcomes, like, it really does need to be maybe less than 6 hours for it to be a strong signal of being detrimental. And I think that the cognitive processes we put on ourselves because we're worried about the fact that we didn't sleep enough, I think those are worse than the fact that we just didn't sleep that great last night.
Yeah. I had a sleep expert named Jeff Kahn on the show, and he argued that there's only one thing that is beneficial or that he recommends tracking, and that is this concept called sleep debt. And so you establish your particular optimal hours of average sleep. And the way you do that is to go into a very dark room on vacation and have nothing to wake up for. And you wake up and you say, gee, I got 8 hours of sleep. And, you know, maybe there's some genetic differences. I want to ask you about that for sure and cover that. But he says, just look at over a cumulative period of time, the month or 6 months, whatever, how well you're hitting that number. And if you have a weekend of a lot of staying up late and you missed an hour below your average here and an hour below your average again, you're 2 hours of sleep debt. You take a 2 hour nap on Sunday afternoon and now you're back to even. It's a nice, pretty concept that everyone can kind of go forth in an inexpensive manner and just see how you're doing from your historical average. But I'll ask for your comment on that. And then also about the genetic differences between, Mia Moore and I, it seems as though she gets by just fine on vastly less sleep than I do. And it's kind of, I'm not going to say frustrating, but sometimes I dream of being Superman and only needing 6 hours instead of 8.5 or 9 or 9 hours and 15 minutes after hard workouts. And it's like, what's my problem, you know?
So, I mean, the concept of sleep debt, I think it's potentially useful, but only if you use it in the way that it's intended, right? Because if instead you, every night, you document an additional hour of sleep debt that you're never able to recover, is there any benefit there? Because all you're doing is creating additional stress. So that would be my one comment. And yes, you know, in reality, we'd all ideally sleep as much as we're able to every night, but that doesn't often happen. And it's, you know, I think people should put things into place to give themselves the ideal amount of sleep opportunity, which basically just means you actually spend 7 to 9 hours in bed. That's probably the most important thing in terms of actually getting enough sleep, is giving yourself the chance to sleep if you can. So that would be my one comment, is we get, you know, if you're tracking this thing and then it's just a thing that you can't ever fix and it becomes a stressor, then I have similar concerns to tracking the sleep itself. One thing that can potentially be useful is, rather than tracking sleep, so this idea comes from my friend Dan Pardy, rather than tracking sleep, maybe track the things that you know affect your sleep, right? So when did you have your last cup of coffee? Or, you know, when did you get into bed? Or when did you put on your blue light blocking glasses? Or did you have, a hot shower before you went to bed? Did you have the window open and the room was cool enough? So, you know, just rather than tracking the thing, track the things that affect the thing. And then that maybe allows you to put into place better habits that can then support sleep longer term. And so I think that can maybe be useful, and you can diarize it, or just, you know, even just think about it. The genetic aspect, there's obviously a big genetic component to sleep requirements. So like what sounds like in your relationship is very similar to my relationship. I need a lot more sleep than my wife does. And that's, you know, initially what I did is I was like, well, there must be, like, what are you doing wrong that means that you can't sleep anymore? Which is entirely the wrong approach. I mean, I was just completely off base with that previously. And you then realize that, well, if you're sleeping however much you sleep and performing well cognitively, feeling good, not tired during the day, not falling asleep inappropriately, you know, there's like the questionnaires, like the Epworth sleepiness scale, asks you about how likely you are to fall asleep and like during everyday activities, right? If all of those things are in place, then I don't think it matters how much you slept, because obviously I think you're sleeping enough, and I wouldn't worry about the absolute time. I'd worry about the subjective experience and how you then feel afterwards. So there's a genetic component, and I think there's a genetic component to sleep requirement, as well as maybe susceptibility to the modern environment. So people talk about chronotypes, and, you know, so you go to sleep or wake up at different times of day and you feel most cognitively alert at different times of day. And I think there's some evidence to suggest that it's basically a large chunk of chronotypes are driven by the modern environment. Because when you take night out...
Isn't that interesting? I'm a night owl. I can't stop watching Netflix until 2 a.m. Oh, is that so? What about when you're on a camping trip? Jeez.
Yeah, exactly. So that's right. So these are studies done at University of Colorado Boulder, where they take people and they go camping, and the night owls, you know, people who are normally awake late into the night, their circadian rhythm starts to shift to be closer to morning larks. You know, people who are more awake early in the day or go to sleep early in the day. So my hypothesis, and it, you know, there may be something else entirely that's driving it, but, you know, if there's a certain, it may be that it's a genetic susceptibility to light at night or other stimuli at night that then keep you awake later, that, you know, create shifts in your circadian rhythm, which are present in some people rather than others. It could be something else, but we think that if you put people in a natural light environment, that their circadian rhythms will get closer together. They won't necessarily perfectly align, but they'll be much less starkly different than they were previously. So there's probably an environmental component to sleep requirement as well. And so, like, if you're doing a huge amount of working out, you're probably going to sleep more, you know, so that may be a difference too. And all these things will kind of stack up.
Is there a strong correlation there from energy output to increased need for sleep?
So I don't know if it's energy output necessarily. I mean, there's going to be a component of repair requirements, but one of the driving factors is an increase in body temperature, which is caused by exercise, and then that seems to correlate with accumulation of metabolites in the brain that drive sleep, like adenosine. So there's the process of using up energy through exercise creates heat. That heat is then part of the picture of creating an increased sleep drive.
So how does that line up with all this talk about getting your body temperature cool so that you can fall asleep, getting on your chili pad, taking a bath, and then having that cooling response?
Yeah. So, it's part of it. You sort of like you have one before you have the next, and people will So the act of going to sleep, melatonin release, you know, getting down into deeper, getting down into sleep itself requires, or the body cools itself as part of that process. And so if you heat yourself up beforehand, so people may have had a hot shower or gone in the hot tub or something, and they feel really sleepy afterwards. That's because rapid loss of body temperature is one of the triggers for sleep. And you accelerate that if you heat yourself up beforehand. So getting hot and then cooling down is one of the triggers for sleep. So it kind of ties into it that way.
What other areas of concern do you see with this pathologizing of extreme health pursuits? Maybe a diet would be an obvious one to talk about, but whatever you like, including fitness and training and keeping to your training schedule. And I've spent so much time in the endurance community where I've talked plenty about how I identify all these unhealthy attributes to this type A competitive drive to put in your hard work and stay consistent. And I question whether consistency is even appropriate for, you know, this consistent application of heavy stress when you're pursuing these athletic goals. And I think it was your quote that today's elite performing athlete, whether it's CrossFit Games or Ironman, is doing six times more training than the hunter gatherer or something like that.
Yeah, it can. So I think the most extreme difference is the Tour de France cyclist, where they're just. Yeah, that's the biggest differential, and that's true. And I think so. We can certainly start with that, and then get into diet. It all has to come back to what the goal is, right? So if you are a professional athlete and your athletic performance pays the bills, then you know consistent performance, consistent training, consistent recovery is incredibly important, right? You know, as part of a periodized cycle or competition cycle or season, right? I think that's important, and because it supports your livelihood, I think you have to do that. Kidding yourself that volume of exercise is beneficial to your health. I mean, that's we think that's not true. At that point, you're at the pointy end of athletic performance, particularly with endurance volume. You're probably going to start paying that back later, increased risk of atrial fibrillation, you know, maybe some other detrimental factors, you know, increased risk of infections. And you know, we certainly see a very high volume trainers. We start to see some changes in the immune system that are similar to those that we see in people who are insulin resistant with metabolic syndrome. And, you know, that seems to be part of this continuous inflammatory process. Increased oxidative stress then affects insulin signaling. And with high intensity exercise repeatedly in like an overtraining or overloading period can actually start to create some things that look like insulin resistance because of that stress. So yes, you may then adapt and perform better later, but don't tell yourself that this is going to make you live longer, because the evidence suggests that it won't. You can have too much too much of a good thing. And in reality, the kind of volume that looks optimal for long-term health is going to be 30 to 45 minutes of brisk walking and lifting weights a day. Like, that's it. You know, maybe you add some sprinting in there occasionally. The volume that you need to get maximal benefits from exercise is much, much smaller than what those athletes are doing. In the consistency phase, consistency realm, I still think it's important to be consistent if it's consistency and behaviors that sort of like support your long-term health. So, you know, consistently just doing some exercise, or consistently, you know, eating a diet that supports your health. And that doesn't, and the other side of that is acknowledging that sometimes that doesn't happen. And actually that one meal or that one night of sleep or that one missed workout doesn't really matter. But for long-term health, you know, getting it done 80 to 90% of the time, that's what really matters. So consistency can be important, but don't kid yourself that like the absolute maximum of everything is going to be beneficial. Then you do potentially see a detriment. And the other thing that comes from that, there was a really interesting study using NHANES data where they looked at individuals and they looked at how much exercise they did with they had pedometers. So they actually measured activity. And then they asked them, how much do you think you do compared to people like you? And then they adjusted for a whole bunch of stuff, like everything related to the environment and health and all those kinds of things. And they found that within a category of people, like the amount of exercise they do, after you adjust for the amount of exercise they do, if you think that others are doing more than you, if you think you're doing less, if you think you should be doing more, that had a negative impact on your health and actually increased your risk of mortality. So this continuous, like, I need to do more, I'm not doing enough, that cognitive process may create a negative physiological environment that could damage your health. So always thinking you need, like, that's, again, that's the problem with optimization is I'm not doing enough, I'm not, I could be better, you know, everything needs to be improved, I'm not at optimal yet. I think that negative thought process can actually affect our physiology.
FOMO.
Yeah.
I mean, Dr. Sinha calls this a actual disease with metabolic consequences, and he's relating mostly to the consumerism and his patients in Silicon Valley who are the single most affluent working population anywhere on the planet, and they widespread suffer from FOMO because their neighbor might have 10 times, 100 times more wealth than them with all that crazy disparities. But yeah, I think the marketing machine pounces on this too, especially in fitness, where there's, you know, females with glistening six packs, which is probably below their genetically optimal health baseline. But if you're not up to that standard, you're going to keep sweating in the gym and feeling like less than until you break through. And then meanwhile, you're purchasing a lot of goods and services that are promising that.
Yeah. And I think you're right. A lot of it is probably deeply tied into this, comparing yourself to others, always thinking that, you know, the grass is greener or somebody's better. And I think, you know, to the extent that people can work through that process, you realize that, you know, probably so acknowledging that you're doing enough in both in the fact that it doesn't, you know, that you probably are doing a huge amount for your health already, right? Somebody who eats home cooked real food, gets 7 hours of sleep a night, you know, goes to the gym 2 or 3 times a week, walks the rest of the time, right? That person is already doing all the things that we think are optimal, right? You know, maybe they walk and go and meet a friend, so they have some good social connection, right? So acknowledging that you're doing enough is important, both because you probably are doing enough, or a lot of people are doing enough there, right?
One, because it's true, and two, because it's true. Good for your mental health.
Exactly. And then it's also not detrimental to negative to your mental health, which we know that these sort of comparisons can be. And again, I think, we're talking about overall long-term health for the average person. Mm-hmm. That in the elite performance environment, we have to take a different approach usually. But again, acknowledging that's not necessarily, we're sort of maybe borrowing from some future health in order to perform now. And that's fine. You just acknowledge that and that's part of it. There's no problem with that. We just need to know that that's the case. With the diet stuff, so continuous glucose monitoring has become, continuous glucose monitoring has created the pathology or has supported the pathologization of food. And don't get me wrong, food is, you know, has a massive effect on our health. And I'm not saying that it doesn't, because it does. However, I would argue that most people who do continuous glucose monitoring don't need to do it. Outside of diabetes, there is some data that suggests that continuous glucose monitoring improves health outcomes in people with diabetes and can also improve their behaviors, because, you know, they'll eat something, they'll see a massive glucose spike, they'll see that they need to inject more insulin, and that can actually improve, maybe start to improve some of their health behaviors. In biohackers, I think there is a potential utility of identifying foods that for you cause big spikes in blood sugar, because we know big spikes in blood sugar can cause blood sugar crashes, it can affect the sympathetic nervous system, it can affect cortisol release, right? So it can affect hunger later on. So big spikes in blood sugar are probably something that we want to avoid happening frequently. I think we can agree on that. And we should also now agree that the glycemic index of a food is a completely useless piece of information that means nothing to anybody, because we know that how individuals respond to foods, carbohydrate containing foods, incredibly different from person to person, right? You and I can eat the same banana and they have a very different, like, I could have no spike, you have a big spike. And then we eat a piece of cake and I have a big spike and you have no spike, right? And there's nothing from, you know, the glycemic index or the ingredients in the food that would necessarily tell us that. So if you did, say, 2 weeks of continuous glucose monitoring, okay, maybe you identify something that you eat regularly that you thought was pretty good but caused a big spike in blood sugar. And then you'd be like, okay, maybe I'll eat less of that. That's useful information to have, and I think that that's fine. What I don't understand is why you would then continue to monitor for more than 2 to 4 weeks. Because we eat the same thing again and again and again and again and again. Like, we're creatures of habit. I eat the same thing multiple times during the week, right? And so if I just monitor myself while I eat those things, that's all the information I think that I need. Because what then happens if you continue to monitor is you create an anticipatory stress response to the food that you're about to eat, right? And I've seen this on Instagram where people, you know, they have continuous glucose monitors and they're like, I'm going to eat this piece of cake and it's going to cause this big spike in blood sugar and I'm already stressed about it. And the thing is that, yes, okay, the cake is probably going to cause a spike in blood glucose. I would argue that if you're going to enjoy that cake in the right scenario, I wouldn't worry about it. But equally, we know that if you anticipate a bigger blood sugar spike, you will have a bigger blood sugar spike. So there was a study done by Ellen Langer. This was in diabetics, but she gave them a milkshake, and they crossed over, right? So two different milkshakes. One milkshake, and they got to read the nutrition label. So, like, this is how many carbs are in here. And obviously, diabetics, particularly if they inject insulin, they know, right, I eat this many carbs, I have to inject this much insulin. So they look at this. They have a high-carb milkshake and a low-carb milkshake. And they see that, unsurprisingly, the high-carb milkshake causes a much bigger blood sugar spike than the low-carb milkshake. The problem was that it was the same milkshake both times.
Oh.
So they see it. Here's how many carbs I'm going to eat. And it causes a bigger blood sugar spike than if they think there's less carbs in there, right? And so I imagine in your biohacker who's worried about his blood sugar, like, I see these carbs I'm about to eat and I cause a bigger blood sugar spike because I'm expecting it. And then I know my CGM is going to tell me, hey, you shouldn't have eaten that piece of cake. And so there is useful information to be had here, but we can create stress responses around food, particularly, and when we're doing this, particularly around carbohydrates. And I can't think of a better word for it than, I see people do this. It is disordered eating. Like, it is an eating disorder, like, worried about the amount of blood sugar spikes you're going to see on your CGM because of the cake that you just had.
I wonder if you could manifest the opposite, where this cake ain't going to bother me. I'm a all-star at processing sugar and moderate your stress response.
Yeah. So I believe that is true and possible. Like, we know that the placebo effect works, even if you know that the placebo is a placebo. So, right, there have been studies
here, lift
done.
This weight that's got those fake weight plates that weigh 1 pound and it looks like 25, and you you go in there and you get strong from pretending to lift weights. Oh my god!
So they have done studies where, I think particularly in pain control is where they do this, where so most studies, you have a placebo controlled trial, you don't know whether you're taking the active drug or the placebo, but they've done studies where the placebo, like, you know, it's a placebo. Here is a drug. It is a placebo. Take it. And you see improvements in pain response. So even if we know the placebo is a placebo, we can create, a psychological effect that then affects the way that we respond. So if you were like, this cake isn't going to affect me, I'm eating it with my family, it's my friend's birthday, this is important, social scenario, it's absolutely worth me eating this cake, I think you will get a smaller blood sugar spike and worse. Like, you can't mitigate all of it, of course, right? Mm-hmm. It's not magic. But there's definitely the amount of impacts that your thoughts can have over this process is not negligible.
Man, the brain is infiltrating everything. We're always coming back to Dr. Tommy's baseline here. It's just messing with all our notions.
Yeah. So it's funny because, like, the more time I spend thinking about this stuff and working on these things, and, I've worked with some of the top athletes and performers in the absolute world, like household names, and you sort of, and I've worked with all the fancy tests that you can, like, throw at a person to try and understand their physiology. And I just, most of it just doesn't really matter that much. Like, and or the information is wrong and you kid yourself that it's useful when it isn't. Right? So we see this with a lot of genetic testing. And what happens is you're like, some of it's just like self-fulfilling prophecy. So this says, oh, well, because of this genotype, you're going to respond really well to this type of training. And you're like, oh yeah, I like that kind of training. I'm that kind of athlete. That's right. But then at the same time in the report, it'll be like, oh, well, because of this genotype, you shouldn't eat this food. And you're like, well, that's not true because I eat that food all the time and I feel great. So like you take the bits that kind of fit into your worldview and you just ignore the rest. Mm. And this is what happens with the vast majority of, you know, complex testing and complex data. We're like, we pick the stuff that already tells us what we wanted to know and then we just ignore the rest. So then I just be like, well, maybe we just don't need to do that because the, you know, the big rocks for most people, for the average person, you know, that's it does matter. We know that matters, and that's where I would focus rather than trying to optimize this or that.
Wow, that's interesting. It takes me back through the decades of athletic training and how incredibly sophisticated it's become. And indeed, we see continued progression with a lot of the records and the raised standard of play in the NBA. I don't think your favorite Spurs of the 90s could compete with today's team because everybody on the court is shooting threes accurately and all that great stuff. But putting that aside for a moment and thinking of, you know, Rocky Balboa training for the fight against the laboratory created Drago and the great athletes of decades ago, whose performance standards still stand in certain areas. El Guerrouj's mile record is 25 years old. The high jump record is 30 years old. And these guys were probably out running on the packed sand at low tide and doing all kinds of rudimentary stuff that still, you know, holds to the highest standards. And they probably enjoyed themselves and had more playful aspects. And there's so much research about that versus just this linear approach to peak performance in athletics or anything else.
Yeah, and, you know, so it's absolutely true. Athletic performance has continued to get better. Across most sports. Obviously, David Epstein makes the argument that most of it is due to improvements in technology rather than in terms of raw human performance. So you put today's athletes back on cinder tracks, right? They're going to run a lot slower. That's an aspect of it too. But of course, we've improved sleep and recovery and periodization of training. It used to be much more. So before people were professional athletes, you know, it was obviously a little bit more haphazard, but then we got to the point where most training models were pretty attritional. Like you just beat yourself down for as long as you could. And then those people who survived that kind of training were the people that rose to the top. But now we have a much better idea of, you know, individualizing training based on responses, maybe a bit of physiology, you know, check some heart rate variability and you make sure people sleep properly and you know, pay attention to nutrition. And so like all this stuff does matter absolutely for like peak performance. The problem is when we take that and we say, all of this is important to make sure that I don't get Alzheimer's disease in 40 years time, when in reality, that's probably not the case.
So we kind of, just to stay on fitness for a moment, you communicate this pretty low bar for health optimization. Hey, I'm getting my 40-minute walk and I go into the gym and throw weights around once in a while. And then here I am, you know, and same for you. Like we get a great amount of positive energy and satisfaction from pursuing elevated athletic goals that very possibly could tiptoe us over that red line of optimal into, I mean, right now my glutes and my high hamstrings are sore for an extended period because I messed up and did too much in previous weeks. I don't think that's furthering my health, nor is it furthering my fitness goals. So, you know, how do we walk that tightrope where we want to get that pleasure and satisfaction from pursuing incredible goals and competing, whether it's with ourselves or others? And I'm mostly competing with myself, but I'm just as intense as whether I want to beat my next door neighbor at the high jump. I know I already can. So it's mainly about myself, but it's no less a level of intensity. And I know that sometimes gets in my way and compromises my long-term development and all those things. So if you have any thoughts on that, we'd love to hear for the competitive types listening.
So I obviously don't have the perfect answer. You're right. I know that my strength, my muscle mass, my cardiovascular fitness, which are all pretty good compared to the average population, they're more than they need to be for me to maintain ideal long-term health, right? I've got a much bigger buffer than I need, really. And I acknowledge that. I don't need as much muscle mass as I have. You know, if I look at data from like average people at their VO2 max and, you know, their risk of death, you know, if I maintain mine where it is, you know, it's probably higher than it needs to be for like optimal long-term outcomes. And so, right, then I need to balance, does that matter to me now versus long-term? And humans are really, I mean, we're terrible at that, right? we're really very bad at long-term planning. So I do those things, one, because there's still, you know, the not very helpful voice in the back of my head that says, you know, you should have X shape, you should look X in the mirror. And I know that those are my own issues to work through. I don't think they're necessarily beneficial. But equally, in order to motivate me to go to the gym, which I know is important, I need to have some kind of target, or else like things just get boring, or, you know, I'll skip more and more workouts. And that, because that's just, I understand my own motivation. So if I sign up for a strongman competition, then I know I have this competition coming up and I need to get in the gym and work out. And I'd like to think that as I get older, the structure of my training, maybe not the volume currently, but the structure could stay the same. Like I lift weights 4 times a week and I do some kind of cardiovascular workout 2x a week, right? I think, you know, that could go down to maybe 3 and 1 or something, you know, or 2 and 1. You know, that's probably going to be enough. So I think that structure is sustainable, but maybe not the volume. And, you know, I'd like to think that I could, you know, compete as a master strongman when I'm 60, right? That would be a nice goal, right? So I think there is a part of you which is, you know, what do I need to do in order to keep myself consistent and keep doing these things that I know are beneficial, versus, you know, just being honest with yourself about what is it that I think I want now versus what's going to be beneficial in the future. That doesn't mean that gives you an answer, but I think you should just know, right? So like I said, I know that I don't need as much muscle mass as I have to survive a long time. Right. And actually, I don't even know. So this is the interesting thing for me. It might be bad, right? The amount of muscle mass that I have, and I don't, again, I'm not, if you look at Instagram, I'm not like the biggest or the strongest person by miles.
Nevertheless, people, this modest man here is pretty jacked, especially if you're lining up the professors at UW or whatever other population you mix in, a picture of fitness for sure. But yeah, it's an excellent question to ask. Like,
yeah. So the reason why I'm making this point is that, right. So again, depending on who I compare myself to, right. Not that big, not that strong compared to the population. I am big and strong. I appreciate that. However, if I want to look at study, and I've done this recently, I've done these like statistical analyses of population data sets myself, looking at say muscle mass and how long people live. There is nobody in a population data set that I can get hold of that looks like me, that has my body composition, right? So I know what the average person, the amount of muscle mass the average person could have and would live along, you know, in the general population. And I think that's useful. So I can give recommendations about that. But if I was like, well, if I found somebody, you know, with this amount of muscle mass and this amount of body fat, how long do they live? I don't have that data. I just don't know, right? There's a theoretical possibility that those people die sooner, but we just don't have that data. So it's worth bearing in mind that when we think about things like cardiovascular fitness and muscle mass and longevity, we're talking about data from truly average general population people, right? And then you or I, right? There's nobody in NHANES who has the body composition that you do, Brad. So NHANES being like this big population data set in the US where we look at this stuff.
Interesting. That's like the Cooper Institute, the famous study that I talk about a lot, the competency in the 1 mile run at age 50. And they laud that very highly, even better than blood pressure readings and blood markers. And so they have a lot of people went through it. Tens of thousands of people did their time in the mile at 50. And if you were under 8 for male, under 9 female, you were exceptional. And if you were over 12 or over 13, you were in the needs to improve high disease risk category that you couldn't even go when asked to go all out, mind you, with a stopwatch and a white lab coat and clipboard, that's not very impressive, and it shows that you're on a bad path. But I think what you're getting at is like, okay, what about the person who runs a 5:12 at age 50? We don't care or know much about their prospects, but you know, getting under 8 for the average runner who's competent, that's not a big deal. But yeah, the outliers that reminds me, like I'm asking this question, like who's going to live to be 123 and break the record? Or is it going to be the yogi who meditates for 2 hours every morning, like Deepak Chopra, and walks around and eats a little bowl of rice and then does some stretches? Or is it going to be the person who maintains this impressive level of functional muscle mass and athletic exploits up into the record setters in the Masters track? This guy Charles Alley, at the age of 70, broke 60 seconds for the quarter. It's just absolutely astonishing. He's like, it's like grandpa coming out of the stands and running the anchor leg on the mile relay for a high school varsity track meet. I mean, that guy seems like he has excellent longevity prospects, but maybe we're interpreting this with blind spots.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point that I'm trying to make, is that we assume that more is more, and in reality,
more is better.
Yeah, more is better. And in reality, we just don't know. So yeah, we have great. You know, I think if you're a man and you want to live as long as possible, you should have a fat-free mass index above 18 or 19, and that's something you can measure. If you take how much you weigh and then you remove your body fat percentage, and then so that's your total lean mass, you know, organs and muscle mass and bone and that kind of stuff, and then you can calculate an index similar to the BMI. You divide it by your height in meters squared, right? And so that is probably the amount of muscle mass or lean mass that you need for optimal long-term health for the average person. I think that's great. But if you have a fat-free mass of 25 or 26, which is right at the upper limits of what most people could possibly achieve with very intense training and focus on, you know, nutrition and recovery and all that kind of stuff, and focus particularly on weight training, there's no data from people like that, right? So I just don't, like, if you get to that point, is more better? Almost certainly not. So that's like, and you're right. If you can run less than an 8-minute mile, we know, you know, for an average person, that's associated with great VO2 max. We know VO2 max is an amazing predictor of longevity, probably the best one that we have. It's something you can easily improve. And anywhere and what's nice is it's pretty much linear up to about maybe 40, a VO2 max of 40 to 50. So wherever you start, any improvement, it has a very significant effect on your longevity. And so that's something we know. But if you run a 5-minute mile, is that better than somebody who runs a 6 or 7-minute mile? My guess is probably not, in terms of longevity. And also because of what you had to do in order to be able to do that. Certainly not something I'm going to do anytime soon.
Right. Interesting. VO2 max, listeners, if you're not familiar, it's a volume of oxygen you can process per kilogram of body weight. So it occurs to me, I've never thought about this, but the less body weight you have, right, your member's going to be more favorable. So you're talking about a lean person who also processes oxygen well. So you're kind of hitting it from both sides. And that's why the great Bjorn Daly and the cross-country skiers and El Garouge have put up the highest VO2 max numbers, is they're extremely lean individuals and they have a tremendous amount of oxygen capacity. So the average person can improve by getting in better shape, and then they hit some ceiling where they get the 5 stars, and then they're good to go from there, I suppose, is what you're saying.
Yeah. So there was a nice study in JAMA Network Open that came out 4 years, like I think 4 years ago, 2018, Mansanger et al., which looked at cardiorespiratory fitness measured as VO2 max in people doing a treadmill test. And again, it's just sort of regular people. And then they classified them by their level of cardiovascular fitness. And they also separated it by sex and age group. So they had like below average, above average, high, and elite, they called it. But we're not talking elite athletes. This is sort of elite regular people. And you can actually go, I can send you this table, and you can like read it off and be like, here's my age, here's my VO2 max, and like, here's where I stand. And then you can see how that correlates with longevity. And again, it's not, so in somebody my age, to be in the like above average or high group, you need a VO2 max around 40 or 45. So, I mean, that's fairly high, but it's not elite athlete by any stretch. So, you know, these are sort of average people numbers. And what's nice is that you don't necessarily need to go out and get a formal VO2 max assessment. There are some good proxies. So there's the Cooper run test, right? That comes from the Cooper data you talked about earlier, right? So how far can people run in 12 minutes is how they do it. And then you can use your body weight and your distance to estimate your VO2 max. If you prefer a rowing machine, then if you get on a Concept 2 rower and you row 2,000 meters as fast as you can, then there's a calculator based on a couple of studies on their website that can estimate your VO2 max. So there are like ways to estimate this. But basically, if you do a max effort in like 5 to 15 minutes, and it could be max effort on the bike or a run or the rowing machine, if you either in a set amount of time get further or for a set amount of distance get there faster, your VO2 max is improved. So that's just like that's like an easy way that anybody can sort of test themselves against themselves over time to see if their VO2 max is improving without having to like really measure the number.
Without having to go breathe into a mask on a treadmill to the point of complete exhaustion. Those were some of the hardest things I've ever done in sports, is going in the lab and doing the VO2 max test. Okay, so we have this sensible and basic, not necessarily extreme commitment to fitness. We're going to be choosing the right foods and going back and listen to the other Tommy shows where we got more into those details, and a really sensible approach. But then I guess like layering back in that stuff we talked about, mindset, forming this incredibly empowering mindset where you're going to use the placebo effect to your maximum advantage and saying, I'm going to live a long time. I'm going to feel great. I do this and that. It might not be perfect, but it's enough to get me to the exceptional category. And then I guess you're firing on all cylinders in that respect. But now that I've made that rant, I also want to ask you about these rationalizations and cop-outs that we hear in general everyday life, where, you know, I'll be talking with my peers or whoever, and they think they're really healthy, but they, you know, upon further scrutiny, you might want to look at that visceral body fat score and see what's in their cupboard and how much refined industrial seed oil is still present in the diet. And I think a lot of us are kind of delusional for some reason, and it might not be serving us. So what's the right way to leverage that empowering mindset and also get your shit together?
Yeah, it's a good question, and one that, you know, I've struggled with in various ways, because, right, so you have a friend and you can see that waist circumference, you can see that visceral adiposity right there. Is pointing that out to them going to benefit them in any way? And in reality, it probably doesn't. It probably just benefits you because you feel better having told them that, hey, you know, you don't look great, or you've probably got insulin resistance and that's associated with increased risk of death. So the starting point has to be, are you somebody who's in a place who's interested in identifying things and making changes, right? So like just offloading this stuff onto other people, I don't think is particularly useful. So there's two parts to that. One is that the vast majority of people probably who listen to this podcast already do all the things that you said. And I just want to reiterate that if you have a reasonably good muscle mass, you don't have insulin resistance, you get 7 hours of sleep, you move for 30 to 45 minutes every day, you don't smoke, you don't drink a lot of alcohol, and you have good social connection, you already have probably added 20 years to your life. Like, not even joking. Like, compared to the average population, like that's the size of the effect that we're looking at. And so like everything else in addition to that, teeny tiny, probably not even worth worrying about for most people. So that's that's one part. The other part is, so for others who maybe aren't in that scenario, you need to find the thing that they're interested and motivated to change, right? Or find a way to help them find that motivation if there's something that they're interested in. So it just goes back to, so if somebody's like, my dad had a heart attack at 60 and I'm starting to look like him in the mirror, right? Is that the motivating factor, then that then opens the door. And it's like, well, you know, here are some things that we know will improve your health outcomes, even if you don't change how you look in the mirror, right? Mm-hmm. You can take a weight neutral approach, which can be, or body composition neutral approach, which can be really beneficial to some people, right? Just go out and walk for half an hour a day. May not change anything else, but dramatic effect on your health. Or, you know, maybe it's, you know, here, removing refined carbohydrates or refined seed oils, you know, that's, you know, just remove those from the cupboards, maybe that's the thing, and then waist circumference comes down. So I think it's a matter of finding what motivates the person. And then sort of beyond motivation, again, this is something I've learned from Simon Marshall, more important than motivation is commitment, because motivation fluctuates. Like today, I don't really feel very motivated to go and do my workout. I have to go and do repeated sprints on the rower as part of my program. And to be honest, I hate it every time and it sucks. It really sucks. But I'm committed to doing that because I know I have a competition in 6 weeks and it's going to help me perform, right? So I'm committed to doing it. So being committed to something is more important than having motivation, because motivation fluctuates. So again, finding something that helps you be committed to a change, and then, you know, go and, even though it's not all evidence-based and some behavioral psychologists like hate bits of it because it isn't, it's applicable and it's useful and it speaks to people. Go and read Atomic Habits by James Clear, where he sort of breaks down how you start to build these things, A, into parts of your identity, but also just make it so that it happens automatically, right? Be it that, you know, a 10-minute walk every day, or, changing little bits of your diet or little bits of your sleep. That's kind of how I'd approach it. Although, going back to the fact that most of the people who listen to this, my guess is they're already doing those things. So then just celebrate that and enjoy it.
Hope so. Right. So if we've added that big fat 20-year chunk, now we're getting up into life expectancy of, I guess, 90 instead of 70 or whatever you want to throw on there. And then to go further, it sounds like we don't have a definitive answer, and that more is not better in many ways, including muscle mass, including aerobic, cardiovascular, athletic fitness, including extreme dietary scrutiny to the extent that we're militant about it. Yeah. Don't need to have that monitor on for the next 3 decades straight in order to achieve the thing. So what is that distant zone there if we aspire to go into the centenarian category? Genetics, I mean.
Yeah. Genetics plays a huge role. And you know, there are other things that become important. So, you know, maybe you keep an eye on things like, you know, so some regular blood testing, right? That, you know, that's where I think things become useful. So maybe you look at hormone levels, nutrient status, and just like ticking off the things that are obvious. So, you know, really dysregulated blood glucose or blood lipids or inflammation, right? Inflammation is one of the best predictors, or lack of inflammation is one of the best predictors of living a long life. And then if you do have elevated inflammation, you know, is it an injury? Is it dental disease? Is it, you know, some, you know, a food intolerance or an infection or something, right? So just stuff like that, you know, that you could probably add a few years there, certainly. But everything else, I honestly don't think we know. The majority of longevity supplements or drugs that people might recommend currently, metformin, resveratrol, I think, or the data suggests that in people who are physically active, metabolically healthy, good body composition, I don't think they're going to be beneficial, and they may be detrimental. There's a couple of studies in supposedly healthy older adults. You know, at least they don't have diabetes and other things. If they're taking metformin, they respond on average. So it's not like there's variability, as there always is, but on average, they'll respond less well to an aerobic training program and less well to a resistance training program. They'll gain less VO2 max on average and less muscle mass on average if they're taking metformin versus placebo. So if you're somebody who's doing all the things we've talked about, I don't think there's any evidence that those things are beneficial, and they may be detrimental. Other stuff like rapamycin is probably going to be, is the next big longevity drug. It's being studied in multiple ways, including the dog rapamycin study at the University of Washington. We don't have the answer there yet. It's possible. It works in pretty much every animal model that you could imagine. But we don't have good evidence for humans yet, but it's coming. But it's not at the point yet where I'd be like, this is so good that I would just like recommend it to everybody. I think all of these things, you know, the drugs and all this other kind of stuff that we're recommending, I think the biggest signal is in people who are already down the pathway of chronic disease, and then there's probably benefit. You know, so, but if you've managed to do all the stuff that we're talking about and you're still in pretty good shape, I'm not sure what additional benefit they're going to provide.
Hey, people. Dr. Tommy Wood says, no shortcuts. I love it. we killed it today. We covered so much interesting ground. It was just wild times. I appreciate it so much. We will get you back on the show on regular intervals because we just have to. It's just so fascinating. And tell us what you've been up to and where to connect with you further.
Sure. So I think over the time period that you and I have known each other, I've become more and more of a professor and academic. Obviously, I still do this kind of stuff. I still try and find ways to apply the science to real people. But my day job is running a lab at the University of Washington you know, doing animal studies and trying to figure out how to treat brain injury. That's the majority of my work. Mm. People can, you know, either look me up on PubMed if they're really interested in that kind of stuff, or Instagram is probably the place that you're most likely to find me. I'll usually post, you know, interesting quotes that are very relevant to this arena, or, you know, maybe you'll see a picture of something that's happening in the gym, or a picture of a white boxer.
Occasional rare photo of the magnificent animal, the white boxer. And it is a real thing, people. It's worth following you on Instagram just for that and all the other great stuff too.
Yeah. So at Dr. Tommy Wood, come and find me, hang out with my white boxer, Bowen. She'll be highly appreciative.
Thank you so much, Tommy. Thanks for listening, everybody. Da, 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 da.
Hi, listeners. You may not believe this, but Brad is going to talk about beauty regimens and healthy, toxin-free cosmetics. Yes, this is an incredible new area of personal interest, as about a year ago I noticed, hey, I look and feel pretty healthy and fit all over, except for my skin, and I'd never paid much attention to putting anything on there, but now, oh my gosh, I am a regular with this wonderful vitamin C-enriched all-natural skin serum and numerous other excellent products from a unique company called Beauty Counter. What's important to understand here is that most skincare products contain all manner of toxic ingredients, endocrine disruptors, obesogens, and carcinogens that can harm your health and compromise other devoted diet, exercise, and lifestyle practices. We do not want to get overwhelmed or freaked out here. I know there's so many to-do list items to eat healthy and exercise and sleep, but here, cutting back on your exposure to environmental toxins in every way is a priority. And there's few things more important than what you put on your skin, because guess where it's going? Right into your bloodstream. Here's an interesting tidbit for you European listeners and for you American listeners. Europe, the European Union, has banned thousands of different compounds that are found in conventional skincare and makeup products. You know how many the USA has banned? 11, just like in Spinal Tap. That is not a good scene, people. The responsibility is on us to choose wisely, and that's why I'm so excited about being involved with Beauty Counter, because they do all the research to be sure that you're getting toxin-free, chemical-free products. Oh my gosh, what this means, if you're buying conventional skincare products, there is most likely lead in your lipstick, endocrine disruptors in your perfume or cologne, that stuff that trash our sex hormones, testosterone, estrogen, and all kinds of toxins in things like your antiperspirant. Thankfully, if you go look at beautycounter.com/Brad Kearns, you will discover a clean line of products where every single ingredient in every product is extensively tested for safety. I think you're going to love checking out their product line at beautycounter.com/Brad Kearns and making these simple switches away from toxic-laden mainstream products. Listen to my podcast with Melanie Avalon to go into great detail here about all these concerns. You heard that word, obesogens, I talked about? That's right. Cosmetic products that will actually promote fat storage. Bad deal. So please take a visit there, beautycounter.com/Brad Kearns. If nothing else, try the All Bright Sea Serum in the distinctive yellow bottle. My wrinkles are vanishing as we speak. Thank you for listening to the show. I love sharing the experience with you and greatly appreciate your support. Please email podcast@bradventures.com with feedback, suggestions, and questions for the Q&A shows. Subscribe to our email list at bradkearns.com for a weekly blast about the published episodes and a wonderful bi-monthly newsletter edition with informative articles and practical tips for all aspects of healthy living. You can also download several awesome free ebooks when you subscribe to the email list. And if you could go to the trouble to leave a 5 or 5-star review with Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen to the shows, that would be super incredibly awesome. It helps raise the profile of the BRAD podcast and attract new listeners. And did you know that you can share a show with a friend or loved one by just hitting a few buttons in your player and firing off a text message? My awesome podcast player called Overcast allows you to actually record a soundbite excerpt from the episode you're listening to and fire it off with a quick text message. Thank you so much for spreading the word. And remember, be rad.